Just a quick note, this is part one of a two-part episode on Francis Ford Coppola's film Bram Stoker's Dracula. So there will be a second part to this. Also, I have a quick disclaimer here. Normally, we put out all ages episodes or whatever. This episode, I'm going to have to put the explicit tag on it. If you're under 17, go find a different episode.
All roads lead to Gary Oldman, and finally our road has led here.
Everyone!
Welcome back to Geek Channel 8. I'm Eric.
I'm Rosie.
And I'm Johanna.
I don't think that I am speaking incorrectly when I say this is all of our favorite Dracula, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, this is the one we've been working toward.
Here occurred the frightening and shocking history of Prince Dracula and the woman he loved.
I have crossed oceans of time to find you.
Yeah. Dracula.
There's a sinister, darker side to him. I find irresistible. I have never met any man with such a passion for life. He is unlike any man.
What are you?
Vampires do exist. This one we fight, this one we face, can take on many forms. He is both young and old. He can appear as mist, as vapor, as the fog. And he can vanish at will.
Oh, my love.
The power of his evil desire has no end.
You've got to go to him. And you've got to love him.
He is a willing recruit and devoted disciple. He is the devil's concubine. Dagger!
Join me in eternal life. Your salvation is his destruction.
I want to be what you are. I want to see what you see. I want to love what you love.
And take me away from all this death.
Make no mistake, he must be stopped.
I'm so excited we're finally doing this movie because, first of all, Keanu Reeves is the love of my life. So in 1992, we had our Summer Olympics in Barcelona. The U.S. had the Dream Team basketball team with Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and Larry Bird, and they won gold. The IBM ThinkPad 700C launched in October of 1992. It cost about $2,750 in its simplest form, and it featured a 120 megabit hard drive. Bill Clinton was elected president of the United States. Let's see. Jay Leno took over the Tonight Show. David Letterman thought he was going to get the gig, but it went to Jay Leno. Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs premieres. Mortal Kombat became an arcade hit. Finish him. One of my favorite comedies of all time. Wayne's World came out. I actually have a picture from my birthday. Right after I graduated from high school, my sister gave me a Wayne's World poster for my room. And I still quote this movie on a daily basis to this day. Last but not least, Microsoft releases Windows 3.1.
So that was a bit, would have been a huge year for me, because almost everything you mention, I have something or some kind of connection or story to tell about. So yeah, I guess 92 must have been a really important or big year for me.
And I was 4.
And you were 4.
And I was 18. I already knew you then too.
Yeah. Yeah. We had already met by that point in time. So we've known each other for a long time. I want to get off on tangents on all those things. Like, for instance, I just listened to a podcast about Wayne's World last night. Winona Ryder, last we talked about her, she dropped out of Godfather 3 and was replaced by Sophia. I love Sophia Coppola as a director. Not kind of crazy about her as an actress. So what's going on? This is the next film.
Yeah, basically, Winona felt badly about dropping out and wanted to make good with Coppola again in case they ever got a chance to work together. So she thought, you know, as a gift, she'd bring this script and, you know, just try to warm up that relationship again. And it went much better than she expected it to, because Coppola saw Dracula on the front page and was all about it and really interested in making the film reflect the original intentions of the book and even incorporate some techniques from filmmaking of the time. So there actually are like really no visual effects that wouldn't have been possible in 1897, which is really cool. It's mostly in camera effects or using multiple exposures in order to get what they were going for. And almost the entire thing was filmed on a soundstage. Even the chase scenes at the end of the film were filmed on a soundstage with projected scenery in the background. So that was something I didn't know, because this film, of course, won Academy Awards for sound effects, costumes, makeup, but the visual effects also very impressive for this film.
I remember at the time, after seeing this, I talked to my friend Bear, and he asked me why I liked it, and I said, it reminded me of really old movies. There are techniques and transitions and stuff I haven't seen in, and he had heard that, and I hadn't heard that before I saw the film. He's like, yeah, you know, I read something about where they were only using old techniques and things like that. And I'm like, yeah, like there's like a, you know, double exposures and stuff like that.
The fact that Coppola approached this wanting to have this more bare bones approach to the special effects meant that the costumes had to be a much bigger deal for this film. The things that were real that you could see and touch. So he was all prepared to sink his entire production design budget just into the costumes. He was talked out of this. They said, no, you have to also have sets. You can't just have costumes. But the costumes are really spectacular. And Coppola made a point of wanting this Dracula to look and feel different from the other Draculas. He didn't want to see Dracula with the traditional widow's peak and the cape, you know, wanted a different Dracula and wanted the costumes for the supporting characters also to really stand out as masterpieces in themselves. And of course, the film did win for best costumes at the Academy Awards, so clearly worked out. There was some drama behind the scenes with the making of this film. I didn't know that Gary Oldman was a method actor, but I read in a bunch of places that maybe at the time that this film was made, he was still trying out some method kind of stuff, like sleeping in a coffin. Coppola set it up so that Gary Oldman was completely secluded by himself in order to create that sense of Dracula being apart from everyone else. Meanwhile, all the vampire hunters were all bunked up in one place together in order to really create that sense of camaraderie. But one of the side effects of this is everyone was terrified of Gary on set. He was super intense, like in Dracula mode all the time. And it caused enough of a problem with Winona, apparently, where shortly into filming, they were not on speaking terms for the rest of the production. And it became especially a problem when they actually had to go back and refilm the end to this film. Not to jump ahead, but now that we've done a number of Draculas, I don't think it's going to spoil much to say that the intended ending was to have Jonathan and Mina basically ride off into the sunset together at the end of the film and to end on that happy note. And the test audiences hated this. And part of it was also they had kind of effed up the death scene as well. And George Lucas, apparently, is credited as one of the people who noticed that they had screwed up the ending and suggested a change. Originally, they had just had Mina drive a knife through Dracula's heart, and Lucas was like, no, no, you established earlier in the film that the head must also be cut off. You can't end the film without cutting off Dracula's head.
Thank you. And thank you, George Lucas.
Thank you, George Lucas.
Yes. Continuity officer.
Yeah. And so they were concerned because they were like, we're never going to get Winona back here to film this again. And they said, oh, if it's to cut off Gary Oldman's head, sure, yeah, she'll come back for that. So,
and she did.
And she did.
It's hilarious that the guy who had Luke and Leia kiss is the guy that's like, you already established this. I want to say real quick before we get too far off it, I feel we hear this about every Dracula doll. We heard Max Schreck freaked everybody out on set in Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. In fact, they even made a whole other film about that, Shadow of the Vampire. Like, we heard that about Bela Lugosi. We heard that about Klaus Kinski. I kind of feel like we hear that about every Dracula. It's like, oh, you know, everybody was freaked out and didn't know, you know?
Yeah, maybe it's all bullshit and this is just lore that they're creating, but I suspect not. I think, you know, in order to have the rest of the cast believe that you are a powerful 400-year-old undead superhuman, that you got to act like it, right?
Ironically, the only person we haven't heard that about is Christopher Lee, the guy who actually, if I remember, like, knows what a decapitation sounds like and knows what, like if,
yeah.
Remember he was like a secret agent during the Second World War or something?
Did a little bit of digging into where this fits into Gary Oldman's career, because this segment would not be complete without a little bit of my All Roads.
Mm-hmm.
So Gary Oldman had played Dracula once before when he was 5 in a fancy dress play. And so he'd always had an attraction to playing Dracula. And when the opportunity came his way, because Daniel Day-Lewis passed on it, was too busy with Last of the Mohicans, Gary was all over this. His acting career up until this point had not been very successful, and Bram Stoker's Dracula, in fact, was his first really major U.S. film, or so he says. It also apparently is the last film that he had to audition for, and that everything after this, they've just known they wanted Gary Oldman.
Was he not Sid already?
He was Sid, but it's, you know, it was kind of it was a punk rock film. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that everybody says punk rock now and it's been on the pop charts and stuff like that, but punk rock was a really small niche thing at the time. And so, like, we saw it, but even, I don't know, even when we saw it, Sid and Nancy, it showed one time at a midnight showing.
Yeah. So this was his first major, like, you know, big costume drama, big budget, big production type of film. And actually, this was one of the bigger productions of Dracula altogether. We've talked in other episodes about how many of them were filmed on a shoestring budget, tight timeline, not a lot of resources. But with Coppola behind it, this is one of the bigger Dracula productions. Gary actually had a hard time getting started as an actor. He was rejected from the Royal Academy, where all of his acting idols had gone. He mentions that Malcolm McDowell is one of his major heroes and tells an amusing anecdote. Finally, he met Malcolm and his mother was there and his mother jumped in and said, oh, you're one of Gary's heroes or something like that. So I thought that was interesting, having Malcolm McDowell in my head watching this performance again. Gary took this role because he was excited about the opportunity to play a character where he would really be able to establish the truth of that character. And if anyone tried to come back at him and say, no, I don't think Dracula would have done it that way, he'd say, oh, when did you die and come back to life? No one's going to tell him what his character would and wouldn't do. So he was excited about that opportunity. One thing he says about acting is that when it comes down to it, acting is an antidote to self-hatred, which I think is really interesting to consider in the context of this character in particular. He read the script, thought it was heartfelt, intense, passionate, and really excited to take on this version of Dracula, which was not considered one of the best films of all time. Probably still isn't, except within our circle right here. But it has made, adjusted for inflation, $473.5 million, making it one of the highest grossing vampire movies of all time.
Wow.
So, a big success.
Wow. I think it's like the VHS Strikes Back is the name of the podcast. And I was listening to it on the road. I normally don't listen to podcasts that do the same movie we do before we record one, but I got interested in their recording of Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's a good podcast. I recommend it, checking it out. When it ended, the Wayne's World one started playing, so that's how I listened to that. But their take on Bram Stoker's Dracula, they hated it. They absolutely hated it.
Oh, no.
One of the things they particularly hated was the British accents. They said across the board were bad. They said that, you know, Keanu was at the top of the tree on that, but that, like, it was across the board, the accents were bad. And that got me thinking that, you know, I hear about people complain about bad British accents a lot in movies, not just this one. You know, there are a ton of British actors that do American films or other, you know, Australian, whatever. I don't think I've ever been like, that is a terrible American accent. Rarely do I say that. I said that only about the Texas accent in one of the Draculas we watched. And even that, I was willing to give a pass. It wasn't the worst. And I'm just wondering, how often do you hear people complain about people's American accents in movies? Like foreigners playing Americans?
I've never heard that ever. Now, there have been times when I've seen something where, you know, a British or Irish actor has to have an American accent. Colin Farrell in True Detective, just as an example. You can kind of hear their accent slip through, but it still sounds American. But then again, if you think about it, the American accent, depending on where you are in the U.S., is still very much a blend of immigrants and people from all over the world. So you're still going to get, like, if someone came from a German family and grew up German, but in the South, they still might pronounce some things a little bit differently than other people in the South.
So this is what I was going to I was going to say, I don't think I've heard British actors getting criticized for, like, generic American accents. But I feel like Kate Winslet took a lot of heat for her Mayor of Easton, Pennsylvania accent. And maybe I was just tuned into that because it's the area I'm from. But they were making fun of her relentlessly for, you know, just kind of overdoing, like, wooder. You know, like the way and the long okay. O's. Like,
maybe anyway. Maybe if you're trying to do a specific regional accent in the U.S. But I've never been like, that doesn't sound like someone I wouldn't run into in America. And I think it's because we are this melting pot. I used to go to a lot of government meetings here in New England, and there are people that have straight up British accents that live here. You know, they're not British at all. You know, it's just that, I guess, for generations or whatever, that's just how their family sounds, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. And apparently, just on the subject of Keanu Reeves' laughable British accent, apparently the problem was that he wanted to get it perfectly, and
he didn't.
He didn't, and, like, so he was just trying too hard. And so it's not, like, that his accent is inaccurate. It's actually that's all he's doing when he's delivering his lines, is just trying to nail that British accent. And Coppola loved him so much as a person that he just let go.
I don't understand what Keanu has on, like, what dirt he has on big directors. Sorry, Rosie, but I'm going to pick on Keanu for a second here.
That's okay. I pick on him too.
He gets all these great parts. And, like, I remember, I think a friend of mine joked about this at the time, but I think even Siskel and Ebert, when they were reviewing this, were like, it was like Bill and Ted's Go to Transylvania. And, like, I get it. And like that podcast I was listening to last night, they were like, you know, Keanu is good as long as you don't give him more than about three lines in a movie. So I was like, they're like, I love him in The Matrix, but, you know, but yeah, I also, whenever I think of him in The Matrix delivering a line, it's like, I know Kung Fu. You know, it's like,
you can take Keanu Reeves out of Bill and Ted, but you can't take the Bill and Ted out of Keanu Reeves. And I feel like it took him a couple of decades, really, to just drop that dude-ish type of accent that he had. That, and you know, I he's Canadian too, right? So he has that kind of going on. And I feel like it took him like at least 2 decades to finally drop it. And I don't. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember him ever doing another movie where he had an English accent or a British accent like that.
No, he was in Much Ado About Nothing, which is a Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare adaptation. And he's up against Royal Shakespeare actors. And oh my God, does he stick out like a sore thumb? You're like, is this a comedy? I mean, it is a comedy, but is this like, did they do this for comedic reasons? Like, what? This is just really bad.
I mean, I love Keanu Reeves, don't get me wrong, but there are some movies he probably should have stayed away from or worked a little harder with the coach on before he did the movie. Bram Stoker's Dracula is definitely one of them. It was unfortunate, but he did every other aspect of it. He did well in, just not the accent.
I want to come to Keanu Reeves' defense here, because of all the other Draculas we've watched, none of the Jonathan Harkers have been memorable at all. And the fact that this is a memorable Jonathan Harker at whatever cost, I consider a victory for Keanu Reeves.
Supposedly Coppola said that Harker's not that important.
No.
Like, I guess we all decided that already. Like,
yeah.
So that he wanted to cast a matinee idol in that role.
Yeah, someone that the girls would chase after in the airport.
Quick sidebar is I tease him, Keanu, but it doesn't come from a bad place. There are, you know, I would do this. Well, this almost happened for real. Like, I was working on a film with a woman very closely, and I'm not going to say what her crew role was and what my crew role was, but at one point she was on the phone with the guy that was cat sitting for her, which was Alex Winter. Alex Winter played Bill in Bill and Ted's. And so I'm in the background, like, doing my Keanu voice and stuff like that. And she's like, cut it out. Like, that's his best friend in real life. You know, it's like, but like I said, it's with love. So let's jump into the story here. This is the first time I think we get an attempt at a Dracula origin story. And that is one of the things that I really liked about this. When I entered the theater and this thing opened in the Middle Ages with Vlad Dracul fighting the Ottoman Turks, I'm like, this is what I've wanted for a while. Let's hear, where did Dracula actually come from? So I thought that was really cool. The armor was a little bit strange.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and I remember the first 15 or so times that I saw the film, it would kind of rankle me. I'd be like, it's like kind of gross looking. It looks like the sinew of muscles and, I don't know, like it. It's not sexy enough for my Gary Oldman. And I've warmed up to it. After, like, between viewings 15 and 20, I've decided actually it's really, really cool. And not boring at all. Like, I mean, and that's one thing about the costumes is they are not falling into any kind of predictable mold. So, points there.
Did you notice that the castle looks like a man sitting on like a throne in armor?
Yes, and I was going to talk about that.
Okay, I was hoping you would.
I hate the castle design in this.
Yeah.
I don't mind a more vertical castle, but it literally looks like someone sitting on a throne. And it takes me out of the movie every time they show that castle. Mm. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I prefer a more gothy looking castle, but whatever.
I want to defend it. I want to defend the castle just as a concept. Not that I think they necessarily pulled the concept off, but one thing I love about this version that I don't think any of the other versions we've seen succeeded at is the sense of the novel being about the past, like medieval Europe and feudal Europe, that past colliding with modern Britain. And nothing but like a castle shaped like a dude sitting on a throne could really hammer that home of like, this is a different time that they are from. I like the touches that they have throughout. I agree with you. It is a little weird looking and sort of like, you didn't nail the landing on this one, but.
We were like, is that supposed to be the devil? What is that? Is that the devil on his throne? What is that supposed to be? I don't. Anyway, something else, though, that I noticed very early in this film is, okay, so basically the backstory to Dracula is he is on the frontier of Europe, defending Europe from invading Muslim forces. You know, he is God's soldier. And then after this victory where he like impales people on pikes and stuff like that, vengeful Turks or whatever sent a message into the castle by arrow or whatever saying that he had been killed. And then his wife jumps to her death. He comes back and he's really upset about this. He curses God's name and he takes his sword and he stabs the cross with it. And the cross starts spurting out blood, and there's just blood everywhere, and like it's just gushing out. And then this is the point where I'm like, oh, so this is where we're going with this film. This is not going to be a literal film. Like, there's going to be a lot of allegory in here, and there's going to be a lot of symbolism. So I think you got to get yourself in the mindset with some things, and it didn't work with the castle for me, but for some things in this, you're going to have to get your head in the mindset that this is going to be a fairy tale version of Dracula. This is not going to be a realistic version of Dracula.
Realistic version of Dracula? I mean, there are vampires in it.
I know, but what I'm saying is, if you watch the BBC version that we watched, you are going to be able to believe that those people in those costumes existed in that place, you know, and time. You may not believe the supernatural aspect of it, the vampire, but you could believe that. Gary Oldman walking down the streets of 1890s London with John Lennon glasses.
Yeah.
I don't think they even had, like, you know, sunglasses.
Yeah, I think glasses were still relatively new, let alone sunglasses.
He looks like he walked off Carnaby Street, you know, or is from Austin Powers or something like that, you know, swinging. That's like swinging 60s Dracula.
Yeah, exactly. This all goes back to that whole thing where you can tell what decade a film was made in, a period film, but you can tell what decade it was made in, kind of like when the 70s does, the 20s. This is another thing where the 90s does the 1800s.
Okay, so I didn't want to jump that far ahead, but I had to use that example to explain my thought process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Harker, who is a solicitor, I guess that's like the British version of a lawyer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has to go to Transylvania. Again, Renfield's been there before him, came back insane, so now they're sending Harker to arrange the sale of Carfax Abbey, and they don't really go into other London properties, but they do say that he's buying multiple, and, you know, is this the corner of the market, dude? You know, that is mentioned. We don't get the whole following him from location to location like we do in some of the others.
But they do take words directly from the novel. We don't get the scene at the inn where I always felt that scene went on too long in every other adaptation we watched anyway, but the lines that they take from Harker's diary are right from the novel. I had this distinct feeling of going from the west to the east. They drew out the important lines from those passages in the book.
Yeah. And, you know, the blood is the life.
Some bloody wolves chasing me through some blue inferno. Or... listen, the children of the night. What sweet music they make.
So go ahead and take us through a little bit about the castle part here.
He transitions from the stagecoach with the other passengers who don't speak to him, but do give him a little cross and sort of say, like, you're doomed. Have fun with that. And he gets picked up by the other carriage driver who has a distinctly supernatural aura about him, picks him up with one hand and transports him into the carriage. some nice touches there, implying that this probably is Dracula driving the coach. They go through the blue flames, which, side note, are the only special effect in the film that was not done with a technique that could have been done in 1897. It's one of the only things that's done in post. And I don't like this representation of the blue flames, personally.
I didn't either.
Isn't this the only movie that has it?
It might also be the only movie that has it.
It's in the book. It's in the book. And
it's in the book, but why is it a circle? Like why? Why?
This is what I wanted to mention. There's a lot of stuff in Stoker's own novel that I'm like, why? What is this all about? It's a shame we don't have Courtney for this one, because maybe it meant something to the Victorians and doesn't mean anything to us nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so traverses the blue flames, gets to the castle, and we see Dracula's shadow before we see Dracula. And I love the use of Dracula's shadow in this film. I think it's one of the things that is viciously lampooned in Mel Brooks's Dracula Dead and Loving It. But the use of the shadow here is really great. We see the shadow and then we pan towards Dracula, who looks unlike any other Dracula we've ever seen. The white hair that is done up in like a heart-shaped, you know, Queen of Hearts haircut right out of Alice in Wonderland with the braid all the way down the back is both elegant and also disgusting at the same time.
Yeah, I gotta agree with that. But the shadow is something that goes all the way back to the 1922 Nosferatu, right? We see the shadow coming up the stairs, not Orlok himself. It's a bit of an homage to that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it really helps establish that the character has a larger-than-life personality, like so large that a shadow has its own consciousness. And then it turns out that Dracula is actually a pretty polite host, you know, sets out dinner. We don't have any of the awkwardness that we have in some of the other versions where he's like, servants have the night off. Sorry, I'm hosting you by myself. Like, he actually seems fairly welcoming, and Harker seems more or less at ease, you know, laughing at what he thinks are Dracula's jokes, only to find out, oh, sorry, that wasn't a joke. My bad.
I have offended you.
I don't know about a great host, because he does, like, draw a sword and...
Yeah, Dracula says that the partnership with the Catholic Church was not entirely successful, and Harker is like, oh, yes.
And so he grabs a sword and like holds it up to him, you know? I'm like, okay. A little bit touchy there.
I love this speech, though. This scene of we Dracules have a right to be proud.
We Dracules have a right to be proud. What devil or witch was ever so great as a Tilar whose blood flows in these veins?
That speech going on to say, the warlike days are over. The victories of my great race are but a tale to be told. I am the last of my kind. This is another one of these places where the collision of past and present is happening. And I feel like in addition to the love storyline that we have, there's a good case that Dracula also is looking to move into London because he is feeling increasingly isolated and irrelevant here in this castle, withering away, dreaming over his past victories, but wasting away and not the powerful man he was before. And going to London and starting over is a way for him to reestablish the incredible, intense leader and powerful man that he was before.
Do you think that one of the reasons he was pulled to London was also because he felt the pull of Mina, who may or may not have been Elisabetta in a past life?
I think we can definitely see that as a possibility, that maybe, you know, he knows somehow that London is where he needs to go. But I like that the character makes sense as this sort of more rounded person looking to create the life that he had before he lost Elisabetta, basically. Not just in the sense of having a life partner, but also having power and influence the way he did before. And it makes the character more interesting. Like, I don't want this to be just a love story. I want that other part of it, too.
Well, as soon as he sees the locket, he's going to London. Like, that's like...
And I never drink wine.
Rewatching this film, I had forgotten about the scene where they drink absinthe.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
I would have done that, but I had to come up with the pairing before I watched it. So I was already with my pairing before that. You know, I'm a big Francis Ford Coppola fan. Nat, I think on the podcast, mentioned how we used to watch Apocalypse Now a bunch. And in Hearts of Darkness, a filmmaker's Apocalypse, the documentary Eleanor Coppola made behind the scenes of Apocalypse Now, in that, there's a scene where Francis talks about exactly what temperature the wine needed to be served at in the dinner scene. He's picky about the temperature of the wine on a movie set, okay?
Something somebody watching the movie would never pick up on. It's completely irrelevant.
So, of course, I said I needed to go with a wine from the Coppola Vineyards.
Nice.
So I went with a 2021 Francis Coppola Diamond Collection Merlot. As we said when we're talking about Sideways, I love Merlot.
I'm not drinking Merlot.
I love Merlot. I don't love Merlot, but I love, if I have to drink a wine, that's my number one go-to. You know, I'm skeptical about all this like wine connoisseur, like it has notes of this, and I think that's all bullshit. According to their website, the Coppola Vineyards website, it, quote, features well-balanced fruit, lush with flavors of caramel, ripe red fruits. Like, red fruits. What is that? Is that like Mad Dog 2020's banana red? Like, what? That's a red fruit. Like, red fruits. There's like a ton of different red fruits and they don't all taste the
strawberries,
same.
Strawberries, raspberries, those are very distinct apple? In themselves.
Like,
That's what I was like, apple?
So anyway, it features well-balanced fruit, lush with flavors of caramel, ripe red fruits, and chocolate. Diamond Collection wines are made from grapes grown across California and are carefully combined to create wines perfect for all occasions, including those special just because ones. Diamond Collection Merlot derives its complexity and lush concentration by blending fruit from diverse appellations in California. I will say that I made dinner before this and opened the wine early. I made lamb, and the recipe for lamb chops that I use is on like kitchen, KITCHN.com. You can look it up. I'm not going to go into that because I wasn't eating lamb while I was watching the movie. I had a glass of wine with lamb beforehand, but then I continued to drink throughout the movie and probably wasn't the best idea because I started getting sleepy. But the winemaker notes, the 2021 vintage, which is what I had, started off cold and dry. Initially, inconsistent weather patterns created a lighter crop, but mild to warm weather later provided perfect conditions to develop phenolic concentration and flavor. Overall, a very nice harvest with beautiful concentrated wines. The flavor profile, scents, cherry, raspberry, vanilla. Flavors, caramel, chocolate, mocha, ripe red fruits. Again, what the hell is that? And vanilla. Blend, 84.5% Merlot, 15.5% other, in quotes.
What?
TA 0.56 grams / 100 milliliters alcohol, 13.5. I guess that's a percent. pH 3.56. Barrel regimen. Portions of the blend aged up to 12 months on a combination of French and American oak. Appellation. The appellation, it was just a picture of the entire state of California with different counties and different shades of red with no context. So I have no idea what this meant. And it had the word California at the bottom. Okay, so they say pairs well with chuck steak and lasagna. I went with lamb chops. Recommended products. Okay, so if you buy this from their website, it does the Amazon thing where it recommends if you like this, you might like this.
Yeah.
And so the other things that it recommended me was Gia Rose, which is, quote, perfectly pomegranate with a touch of raspberry and minerals. A bottle or two makes for the perfect party drink or evening in. A Gia 3-pack, where it says, Gia wines are light and unpretentious. That alone screams pretentious. They say, perfect for impromptu get-togethers, movie night, or sharing with friends. And then, director's cut Sonoma County Cabernet Sauvignon. Quote, outstanding quality with flavors of mocha, toffee, blue fruits. Okay, blue fruits here.
Blue fruits.
Anise.
There's
and
only
Flo.
One blue fruit.
I know. Is there anything other than blueberries that is blue? All right. Anise and clove. And then finally, Sophia. Okay, of course, this is the wine that's named after Sophia Coppola. Sophia Mini Blanc de Blancs Singles. I don't know if I got my French right or not, but it's the mini Blanc de Blanc singles. And it says, quote, delicate effervescence with a hint of citrus and flavors of white peaches, mango, orange blossoms, and honey.
What? No white fruits? Doesn't
white peaches. White peaches.
White the, peaches.
White
okay.
peaches. And this, the interesting thing about this is it comes in a can. You know?
Yeah.
And to which my reaction was, I said, I'd take Sophia Coppola in a can. So there we go. That is what I had. I will say it was a very good wine as far as wines go, but I'm comparing it to the last one I had, which was Mad Dog. So take that for what you will.
One of the things I love about this film is the way it weaves together the different timelines. So I love this cut over to Mina at the typewriter. First of all, awesome that we get to see Mina, you know, competent and doing some of her new woman style work. And love this scene with Lucy in what I think is the best representation of the Weston household, given some of the other versions of this we've seen where it's been like horribly overcluttered, like, everything looks like it's made from curtains out of the Sears catalog in 1970s. And thank God, this version, I actually really believed that these people were very wealthy and had good taste. So love this representation of the Westerner house and the scene with Mina and Lucy looking over 1001 Arabian Nights is a great detail that is not in the book, but probably works for the period that this is set in.
And again, now we have Mina, the good girl brunette, and Sadie Frost as Lucy, the bad girl redhead. And red is kind of symbolic too. She's wearing red dresses and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about her nightgown when we get to that red dress. Like, some of the costumes in this seem very period appropriate. Like the dresses that Mina and Lucy are wearing during the daytime for the most part, seem like perfect representations out of the period. Totally believe they are Victorian costumes. The nightgowns they wear, no.
But wait. No. Even the dresses that they wear during the day, Mina's is all the way up to the collar. Like, she's got a collar all the way, you know, the dress goes all the way. Lucy's is off the shoulders. Like, she's that is a lot of skin to be showing for the Victorian. So it's clear that, you know, she's like almost 20, practically a hag, you know?
I know, right?
You gotta laugh when they're like, Lucy's such a pure and virtuous girl, they say.
Yes.
We talk about the same person here.
You know? The same person who was holding that knife and said, please let me touch it.
I know, right?
I gotta give a shout out to Carrie Ellis. Even on the podcast that I listened to where they were making fun of all the accents and stuff like that, they had to give him credit. He actually got it right, they said, you know, and I think he does. He is always good. And I feel like he's sort of underrated. People don't talk about him that often when they're talking about lists of really good actors, you know? And I've never not liked him in anything.
Yeah, he's chosen. I mean, I think some of it is he's best known for and probably gives his best performance in The Princess Bride. And there's something in our culture about not treating actors seriously when they're in films for children, like that those performances don't count. And a lot of the films he's been in for adults, he has not been a likable character. Like, I mean, I don't want to ruin the films that he's in because a lot of them have a twist ending. He's not always playing a character where you say, yeah, I'm cheering for that guy. So, and when he does, it's usually a family film. I mean, even Robin Hood Men in Tights, I'd say, is pretty family oriented.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just wanted to say, to give a
underrated
shout out to him. Because he is definitely underrated. And he's great in this.
I also think he's important for making this trio of suitors believable. Because Quincy playing the Texan is playing the character of a Texan that is in the book. I mean, like, absolutely out of the book, but would not work standing alone. And we saw that not work in a previous adaptation. And Dr. Seward, likewise, in most adaptations, he's like her father, or like no one has taken him seriously as a suitor. But the two of them paired with Elwes, who is the clear front runner, makes that whole segment of this make sense. And I am so glad it's included. It feels like a really important part of the book, and in most adaptations doesn't show up or isn't done well.
Although we jumped ahead, I do want to say that even back at the castle, Coppola lays on the cheesy effects kind of heavy. This is definitely like, we're making a B movie and we're going to let you know it, you know? So there's like, you know, the liquid dripping upward, you know, rats running upside down, you know, stuff like that. The brides, we didn't even talk about the brides. The brides have the ability to melt across. Like, the vampire powers are kind of like Superman in this, where it's like, how many powers do they have exactly? Like, I can't count, you know? And the bride scene, I thought, okay, again, we got to get into how hot this movie is. This movie is hotter than anything you're going to find on like Pornhub or something like that. This movie is fucking steamy. This is like, there are many scenes in this movie.
Well, because the book is steamy. Like the scene with Harker and the three brides, I mean, like, literally the text says something, you know, and then with her red lips, her mouth went lower and lower. And it was just, it's just very clear that she's about to go down on him in the book. In the book!
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With the teeth. Oh my God, with the teeth, though. Like, that's...
Oh, God.
They keep him drained in bed, right? That's the whole thing. He's, like, constantly, like... You know, he's literally going gray from
all the orgasms.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, and blood loss, you know.
Yeah, and blood loss.
Can I just mention that in that scene, Keanu Reeves was literally a snack?
Yes, he was literally a snack.
literally a snack. I'm just saying. Okay, moving on.
Can we spend just 90 seconds talking about the fact that this is one of the versions where Dracula brings an actual baby for the three brides to devour? I think in every other version we've sort of said, and this is the part where that usually would happen in the book, but it's not here. And this is one of the versions where it is there and oh God.
Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot about that scene when I saw it last night and I was like, oh God. And I mean, I was literally like, you know, just I had the hand up to the mouth, the shock. And I was sitting there, I was like, I completely forgot this was in the film. And I forgot how much I hated seeing this.
Yeah, the one thing that's not in any of the movies, which I think gets you that this is like, there is some serious horror going on here, is the mother shows up. The mother shows up outside the castle, like,
oh God, yes, yes, oh God, oh,
demanding her baby back and like all of that, you know? And that really twists the knife when you read that part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot about that in the book. Oh, yeah. That's horrifying. And evil. I mean, and that's another thing. It's like in the other Dracula versions, you know, we get this hint of evil. But like here, it is not a hint of evil. It is just like out there. Like Dracula is this romantic character yearning for his lost bride, and, you know, he's crossed oceans of time to find her, but laughs when he has this child, like, brutally killed.
So, yeah, if you want to see that rendered visually, I don't know if you do, but if you want to see that rendered visually really well, the Roy Thomas Marvel graphic novel. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I'm a big fan of Marvel's interpretation of Dracula. Okay, so the Demeter. Not the best. I think we decided that, ironically, Vampire in Brooklyn had one of the best Demeter scenes. This falls back on what we've seen in some of the other films. And, you know, honestly, there's no mention of the wreck in the morning and them finding it and Wolf jumping off. None of that stuff happens in this. They're just like, the Demeter's on its way, and then Dracula's just there.
Here ends part one of our two-part analysis of Francis Ford Coppola's film Bram Stoker's Dracula. Please join us next time for the second part of this two-part episode.